Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, October 8th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for another science forum, and we have two experts on the line to field your scientific questions, Roger Jaboni and Ed Stander. The number to call is 800-348-2551 if you have a science-related question, 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. The Science Forum and your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's the Science Forum today, and we have two science experts on the line to answer your questions. Roger Jaboni and Ed Stander, what fascinates you? What do you want to know about? You can ask the experts, even if it's not within their exact field of expertise. They're wicked smart, and they'll give it a shot. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 with your science questions, or voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Ed Stander, welcome back to the program.
Hey, it's great to be back. I'm not sure if I can answer questions that I don't have answers for, but I can do the best I can.
You'll do just fine. How are things going at SUNY Cobleskill?
Pretty good. We have had very, very few cases of COVID, and things are running pretty nicely, as far as I can tell.
For those people who have never heard the program, your area of expertise is?
Geology, astronomy, environmental science, and anything that Roger can't answer.
All right. And so, you know what? You hold that thought on astronomy because we have a couple of questions already for you on that. Roger it'll be all right. Hang in there. Roger Jaboni, welcome back. He's gone. Hello, Roger. Are you there? I think Roger might
Hello.
Be.
Hello.
Oh, well,
thank you. There he is.
How you doing?
Yeah. All right. How are you?
Good. So you guys didn't lose power during the big storm yesterday out your way?
Couple of flickers, couple of brownouts, but nothing serious.
Oh, man, it was really something. Now, for those who have not heard this program, your area of expertise?
General physics, electronics, electrical engineering questions. I'm more of an engineer than a scientist, so don't fit the mold.
Yet. You can answer some satellite questions, too. You've done some work there.
I can try.
Well. Yeah, all right. So
I can try.
We'll come up with a couple of those, and I have a few myself. This email came in before the show started from Andrew in Greenwich, New York. Andrew writes, "Today I saw the moon in the sky during daylight hours. I noticed that it is in a partial phase as opposed to a full moon. Is it possible to see a full moon and the sun in the sky at the same time?" And we'll throw this one to Ed first. Ed.
No. Well, if it's a actual full moon, then the moon has to be exactly on the opposite side of the Earth from the sun, because the sun has to hit it full on, which means that the moon comes up at exactly the same time as the sun goes down. On the other hand, if it's not totally a full moon, and this happens as well, then there's no problem there. You'll be able to see the moon and the sun at the same time, but just for a short period of time, because the sun will set almost immediately after the moon comes up.
You know, we lost power. We still don't have power at my house after the winds blew through yesterday. And so last night we went out, the whole gang went out, and we looked at the sky with no light pollution. And
then fantastic, isn't it?
And then I went out in search of coffee at 5 o'clock this morning, and it was also spectacular. Even though the moon was up, we could see so many more stars. It was breathtaking. So there's that. And Roger, go ahead, Ed.
Oh, no, I'm just wanted to mention that here at SUNY Cobleskill, we're doing work on trying to get the sky back. There's a dark sky initiative trying to get all the villages out in this area to cut their light pollution down so that we're able to actually see the stars at night.
Oh, it would be so great. And, where I live, we go out and we sit by the fire pit and we will be able to see a number of stars, but nothing like last night and early this morning. So there is that silver lining in the fact that I have to throw out all the food in my freezer and fridge. whatever.
Hey, I spend a fair amount of time in the Adirondacks. We have a camp up there, and that's unbelievable. There is no light pollution. And when it gets dark up there, you think the stars are right on top of you.
It's
amazing.
It really is.
Yeah.
One of the things that we see when we are outside, we see what we assume to be satellites. They are either very high-flying planes or they are satellites. And I said, well, I think that they tend to go in the same direction if they're satellites. And I realized I probably don't even know what I'm talking about. As far as the polar orbits and the equatorial orbits, do satellites just go any which way nowadays, Roger?
Well, they are reassignable. Their orbits are reassignable, but they aren't orbital objects. So they follow orbital, you know, Newtonian orbital mechanics. They move in a straight line. They can be redirected, but in general, they follow the standard orbital mechanics. Reconnaissance satellites or reconnaissance is required, where a satellite needs to be tasked to be moved. They can't task it today. Drones at 60,000 feet do a far better job than satellites did. So, there's a ton of satellites out there. As a matter of fact, the low Earth orbit is actually a problem. There are so many satellites up there now. And now that with the advent of these micro satellites, it's really becoming an issue.
I guess my question is, though, do they all tend to go, let's say, west to east or east to west or north to south? In other words, is there a way that my family and I could pick out what is a satellite and what is just a high-flying, really far up there plane?
Maybe you've got a better handle on the direction they travel. I mean, that's got to do with the rotation of the Earth. So maybe you've got a better handle on that.
Ed.
Well, I can tell you that there are actually web pages that you can go on to that tell you where the satellites are and when they're passing overhead.
Mm.
And I don't have the name of it here, but I can certainly find it for you. There's over 2,000 satellites one can see on a given night. In fact, when we have the observatory running over at the college, it's almost impossible to get a picture of a galaxy or something else without a satellite running over in front of it. So if you see something moving up there, and it's moving relatively fast, so it takes maybe a minute or 2 minutes to go across the sky, it's definitely a satellite.
Let's take a quick break here, and then we will get to your calls. The number is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. Ed Stander and Roger Ciboni are here to answer your questions. We'll be right back. Vox Pop, the Science Forum. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Ed Stander is here and Roger Ciboni as well, and they're here to answer your science questions. We begin with Jesse and Troy. Hello, Jesse.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
During the power outage last night, we decided to carve some pumpkins with the kids.
Nice.
And I just had this thought that raced through my head, which was, how does the cavity inside of the pumpkin form? Because you start out, you know, with this little dense, small fruit, and then it gets bigger and bigger and it gets hollow. So is it pulling a vacuum as it enlarges and then air is diffusing in, or is there some other mechanism that deposits, gas inside of this growing fruit?
Oh my God, that is such an old school Science Forum question. I love this question.
Superb.
Ed, you go first.
Yeah, sure. Nothing, pretty well nothing out there in the vegetable kingdom is actually airtight. And air has to actually be able to diffuse through it, because if it doesn't, then anything outside of the surface of the plant dies. So the air is able to get through, oxygen is able to get through, so that's not a problem. There's no vacuum inside of a pumpkin. And as it grows, effectively the stuff forms inside of it. There's really no reason why it shouldn't. Just like in a tree, the underneath the cambium, you get more bark forming, more cells forming. So the cells form as the thing grows. So it's not a very difficult operation. It's just fortunate that it happens that way. Otherwise, the things would blow up.
Well, you make a point.
Yeah, no, I guess I understand that it grow the way that it grows, but and I understand there's not a vacuum inside of it. But as it's enlarging,
mm-hmm.
it seems to me that it would have to pull a small vacuum to get the air to diffuse inside of it.
Oh, well, it probably does. Because as it is increasing in size, you've got more volume inside than there was before, so it's going to have to take air inside. And there's no reason why it couldn't take it through the cells of the pumpkin itself, which, again, as I say, are not solid. So it shouldn't be a problem at all. If I were a pumpkin, I'd be very happy.
Right. Hey, you know, Jesse, congratulations.
That's what I suspected.
You're on the list for the best question of the year, so you're on the short list, man. Thanks a lot. 800-348-2551 here on the Science Forum. Roger Jaboney and Ed Stander. See, Roger, in the old days on the show, we would get questions like, why does clothes hanging on the line smell fresher? And we would go on for about 40 minutes on that topic, or the old standard.
Oh, the good old days.
The old standard, Ed Stander, is the ice in the cold water or hot water in the ice tray, right?
Oh, well, and thanks for bringing that one up. That was very nice, Ray.
Just one thought on the satellite question.
Yeah.
They get back to it until we get the next question.
Sure.
You know, next time you're sitting out in your backyard when you have power, look up the orbital ephemeris data for the space station, and most of the space station people are ham radio operators, and they actively have 2 meters going almost all the time.
Oh yeah,
I've spoken to the space station a couple of times.
With a little walkie-talkie, you can do it. With a little luck,
absolutely. Well, they're only 120 miles.
Yeah.
So, and it's line of sight. So you just have to know when they're overhead.
Very cool. And, of course, the ISS is really bright. I mean, there's no mistaking that one when it goes over. Well, we have a full bank of calls here. Ed Stander and Roger Jaboney on the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. Chris in Housatonic. Chris.
Yeah, I got two questions. Are there new stars forming in our galaxy? And the second question, do the U2s and TR-1s still take photographs like the satellites do? Because I know they get up there to about 90,000 feet, surface ceiling feet.
Well, that's so great. Like so that's two very separate questions. Let's throw...
Right, I can answer the second one.
All right, let's throw the first part to Ed and the second part to Roger.
Okay, the first part was...
Are there new stars forming in the Milky Way?
You bet. They're forming all the time. In fact, they're forming from the dregs of old stars. The best place to see new stars, if you wanted to, would be to look for Orion, which is just starting to come up in the sky. And if you look at, Orion is that nice constellation with 4 stars in a sort of a box, and then there's a belt and a sword that hangs down from Orion. And you can find out where it is very easily by going online. But the second star in Orion's belt is actually not a star. It's the Orion Galaxy. And that galaxy is filled with new stars forming all the time.
Mm.
Also, I should point out that any star that you see in the sky is part of our Milky Way galaxy. There's only one thing that you can see in the sky that's not part of the Milky Way, and that's what's called the Andromeda Galaxy, which is another galaxy which is a good distance away. And it's sort of a mushy area over by another constellation called Andromeda. But everything else out there is part of the Milky Way.
Okay, and then the second part of the question is concerning spy planes, the U-2 and the SR-71. Roger Jaboney.
Well, the U-2, actually, he didn't hit the SR-71. The U-2... To answer your immediate question, U-2 is still flying. It was actively used in Iraq and Afghanistan, but it's rapidly being replaced with drones. And you know enough about the aircraft to know that it was renamed the TR-1 after Gary Powers was shot down. So the same aircraft renamed the TR-1. It's still actively flying. I think they've got 30 or 40 of them still in service. Very expensive aircraft to operate. But it's... you know, it's an amazing airplane, but rapidly being replaced with by drones.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot. You know, I always was interested, Roger, maybe you can shed some light on this. The U-2 has been around for a long, long time, and the SR-71 came along to supplant it, and yet they pulled the SR-71, except for a brief, very brief period where they reactivated it, and yet the U-2 still flies. The SR-71 has ridiculous specs. Why did they do that?
Still classified. The speed on the SR-71 is still classified. The SR-71 is extremely expensive to operate. When they load it with fuel, it leaks fuel on the runway until it gets up to altitude and the skin gets hot enough to close up the openings. I don't want to be imprecise here, but I read a single SR-71 operational costs were equivalent to a squadron of F-35s.
Wow.
Okay. So the SR-71 is a very expensive aircraft to operate. Was designed 18 months after Kerry Powers was shot down. That's an amazing story. Kelly Johnson at the Lockheed Skunk Works designed that. Actually designed both of them. And that's when men designed airplanes, not computers.
Yeah, and quite a plane it is, too. Let's go back to the phones, 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum today. Anything under the sun or above it, whatever you want. Roger Jaboney at Ed Stander will give it a shot. Let's go to Seymour and Saugerty. Seymour.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm pretty well, thank you. I have a dog. The breed is called a Mexican Hairless.
Yes.
Mexican Hairless.
Yes.
Now, the dog is Mexican, and he's hairless. And I'm just wondering, is that the reason why it's called a Mexican Hairless? Now, I'll stop, and I'll listen to your answer. Yeah. Thank you very much for listening.
Well, Seymour, thanks so much for calling. That's very helpful. We appreciate it. All right, gentlemen.
That's such a hard question. I mean, a Mexican Hairless. My guess is that it's probably from Mexico and it's hairless. But maybe Barbara Brabets would be the one to answer that question, because that's a very complicated, genetic question.
Well, just when I thought I've lost the will to live.
Very unusual looking dog, by the way.
All right. Well, thank you for that one. oh, boy. 800-348-2551. Chris in Warwick. Chris, you're on.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Roger, Chris Ollard here. How are you?
Hey, my old hometown and old home rotary buddy. How are you?
Most excellent. I've got a question that I'm sure you can answer. This is not a trick question. I don't have a Mexican hairless. Curious about, and since you are such a wizard with electronics, when do you think we will see the next 6 or 7G or 8G? In computer worlds,
I hate to let you down, but I don't know the answer to that. My guess is these generations of the, and when you've heard of 6G and 5G or 4G, that's the bandwidth for the communication speed, and it just refers to the fourth generation, fifth generation, and my suspicions are. And I'm not close enough to that industry, but my suspicions are they'll get a network up and operating. 5G is just starting to come into play right now. They'll get the network in place. That bandwidth will get consumed by users and data and content, and then it'll basically force the next generation of it. How much capacity 5G has before it starts to run to its limits, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I'm sure there are standards groups, though, that you know, contemplate these issues and say, geez, you know, somewhat like Moore's law, where every year the number of transistors doubles on a chip. I would envision that the consumption of bandwidth is something similar and related to the complexity of the electronics and the data that we push through it.
Roger, thank you. Ray, Ed, you're in the company of a genius. Roger Jaboney.
Oh, geez,
Oh, well, thank heavens there's one around.
Well, thank you, Chris. We appreciate the call.
Thanks, Chris. Great to hear you.
I think they're both pretty – they're wicked smart. Let's face it. 800-348-2551 is our number on the Science Forum. Jim in Peru. Jim, you're up. Hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Hi.
I was out in the yard with my friend – looking up at the sky, and we saw this star that seemed to pulse red, white, and blue.
Mm.
And I was just wondering what your thoughts were about it.
Well, Ed Stander, the pulsing of stars is sort of a common thing, right? So we would need a little more information.
Yeah, well, basically what happens is simple. As the light from the star hits the atmosphere, it gets bent a little bit. Sometimes it bends a little bit to the north, sometimes to the south, sometimes to the east, sometimes to the west. And where you're standing, you're not moving. And the light, as it gets bent, it also gets refracted the same way that light through a prism gets refracted. So what happens is you'll see a little bit of the red light coming through towards you, and then sometimes a little bit of the blue light as the waves bend through the sky. It's important to actually measure this. I have a little device here that I use to measure it because it tells you how quiet the atmosphere is. If the atmosphere is very, very disturbed because there's lots of wind up there, for example, or there's heat coming off the Earth, then you're going to get much more of that wobbling, that twinkling that you get otherwise. So basically, that's what you're seeing. And the colors are due to the fact that you're seeing different parts of the spectrum as it goes through the atmosphere.
Ed, if I could ask or add on to that, does the particulate matter in the atmosphere from the wildfires, is that enhancing this color variations this gentleman is seeing?
Well, it actually isn't necessary. All you need is a bit of heat coming off the Earth and you get it, or a storm coming through or anything like that. If you have particles in there, what that does more than anything else is it just increases the albedo of the Earth. More light refracts off, and it gets a little bit colder on the Earth. That's about it. If the particles are small enough, you can get refraction, but otherwise, no.
So we need more wildfires to get rid of the global warming? Is that the concept there?
Well, you know, you get the same thing at sunset. The reason why the sun turns red at sunset is because it's going through all that wildfire material. Hmm. And, again, it's getting refracted off that material. So if the particles are small enough and there's a lot of it, then you can get that to happen. The particles in the sky, you know, during the day, they cause the sky to be blue as well. So all those colors are due to the fact of refraction of material going as it goes through the atmosphere.
Well, Jim, thank you very much for the call. All right, Ed, while we're on this topic, maybe you can prove me completely wrong here. This is one of these things I tell my children when we're stargazing with great authority, and I'm sure I'm not correct. I say, well, if it's not twinkling, it's probably...
Probably a planet.
Well, no, the other way around. I say if it's twinkling, it's not a planet. That is usually what I say.
That is very, very true.
Okay.
And the reason for it is that the size, well, put it this way, a star is so far away that it's effectively a point source. And therefore, it's like a little, very, very, very small prick in the sky. And as a result, the light is able to get bent a lot. In the case of a planet, because you're looking at a disk, the amount of light is much greater. And if there's any twinkling, it's around the edge of the planet, but you can't really see it because the planet's bright enough.
Mm.
And by the way, on the subject of that, 2 days ago, Mars was the closest it's been in 15 years, and as close as it's been for going to be for another 15 years. So if we continue to have problems with our electricity, it might be worth going outside to take a look at it.
It's spectacular.
And is that mostly visible in the morning, Mars?
No. Mars is in the evening.
Yeah.
It comes up right now. It comes up about an hour after the moon does.
And they were getting close together. The moon.
They were very close together
about
a week ago.
Very cool indeed. And Mars with no light pollution. I got to tell you, we were standing out there, and you could almost reach out and touch it. It looked enormous.
You don't want to do that. It's hot.
Exactly. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum with Ed Stander and Roger Jaboney. And now let's go to Ken in Wilton. Ken.
Yeah, hi, and I'm really liking this show today because I was out stargazing last night after that wind came through. It was a gorgeous night.
Yeah.
And as I looked up, I just want to know, was that Venus or Jupiter or Saturn that I saw that was very yellowish?
That was Jupiter, and right next to it, maybe, I can see your hands there, Ray. Maybe a fist away from it was Saturn.
Yep, and they're getting closer.
That's right.
Okay.
And that's called a conjunction.
Thank you.
And every time the two of them get too close together, everybody around the Mississippi River run away from their town because they think it's going to get they're going to have earthquakes.
Come on. Wow. Really? Is that true?
Seriously.
No, that's not. I remember a time, and I've talked to Bob Berman about this. There was a book in the, 70s or whatever. They said, okay, in 19 blah, 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 78 or 82 or whatever, all the planets are going to line up, and they're going to be
called the Grand Conjunction.
Massive earthquakes, which never happened. But they sold a lot of books.
That's right, which is a good thing. People should read.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Let's do one more, and then we'll take a break and then do some more. Larry in Pleasant Valley. Larry.
Hey, guys. I got a question about the speed of light that I've read that there's a constant number for it, and yet light is affected by gravity. So I guess my question is, if you have enough gravity and it affects light, how could the speed be constant?
Who wants
to take that one, Roger, or should I?
I can at least start the conversation. The speed of light is a constant with the limits that Einstein has developed in our physics question, in our physics equations. It's 3 × 10⁸ meters per second. It's a constant in a vacuum, okay? It changes speed based on the material that it's being transmitted through. So it slows down when it goes through other material. Gravity affects the photons, but only minimally until you get to huge gravitational forces, hence black holes. I don't know about gravity affecting the speed. Ed, do you have any thoughts on that?
I can take that one. Light follows the surface of space or space-time, and space-time can actually be bent by gravity. For example, the sun sitting on, if you imagine the sun sitting on a large latex sheet or a rubber sheet, it bends the sheet. Something that's very heavy will bend it. The light will follow the sheet. And so what happens is it actually goes down into what's called a gravity well as it gets near the sun and then out the other side. So the amount of time that the light takes to get from one place to another can depend on what the geometry of space-time is. I don't know if I've explained that very well.
I think it's tough to understand. I think you explained it very well, but good heavens, I mean, how can a human wrap their mind around that?
The whole idea was first discovered or first proven by one of the moons of Jupiter, Europa, going behind Jupiter. And we knew exactly when that would happen. When Europa would go right behind Jupiter, we could see it. And if Jupiter is on one side of the sun and we're on the other, it takes longer for that light to get to us because it has to go down into the gravity well and then get to us. On the other hand, if Jupiter and we are on the same side of the sun, it takes less time. And so we were able to actually prove that while the speed of light is the same, the distance it has to travel depends on the gravity.
All right, let's take a quick break here. We're a little overdue. Roger Jaboney and Ed Stander join us today on the Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number, and we will be right back. It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Ed Stander and Roger Jaboney answer your questions today. And gentlemen, A few emails have come in, and then we'll get back to the phones. This one is from Rich. Rich says, a village is planning to convert its streetlights to LED. Will that have a greater impact on beneficial nocturnal insects? And that's from Rich.
Nocturnal, it'll do a good job keeping the light away from the star, from the sky, for sure. As far as nocturnal insects are concerned, it's actually a bit better for them because they like blue light, and LEDs tend to give out more blue light than normal incandescent light bulbs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Roger, you want to weigh in on that one as well?
No, that's it. I didn't know what the effect. I was interested to know that what the effect was on insects. But I second the thought that, you know, LEDs tend to be a much narrower range of frequency than standard incandescent lights. That's standard incandescent lights, a broad frequency range of white light, whereas the LEDs, you know, that you can select them in multiple different frequency ranges.
Well, you know, one thing about LEDs is they don't draw much current. And not having had power at our house now for about 22 hours, 23 hours, a couple of AA batteries and an LED light, you can illuminate a room pretty well. So they have their advantages for sure. This email from Barbara. Barbara says, I think I saw a planet early this morning in the eastern sky. What planet would that be?
That would be Venus.
It's very bright. It's beautiful.
Very easy.
All right, and
Venus is either the morning star or the evening star, and right now it's the morning star.
All right, this email is one. All right, I'll let you both have at this. This is another classic science forum question. Frank writes, Frank from Rhinebeck, why does human hair look darker when wet?
Not having had power at our house now for about 22 hours.
Hey, what? Hello?
Hello? Yeah,
hello?
Did you hear the question?
Yes, we did. I did.
Okay.
What? I don't know. You want me to take a crack at it? Or
go ahead.
Go ahead. Take it.
Roger.
I would imagine, I need to think this through a little bit, but I would imagine it has to do with the reflectivity of your hair when it's wet. It tends to reflect different frequency ranges when it's wet versus when it's dry.
What do you think, Ed?
Well, I'd have to do some research on it, and my hair is falling out, so it's a pretty good time to do it. Basically, if the hair is wet, then light will be able to penetrate into it deeper because it gets bent by the water on the outside into the hair and then back out the outside. So it may appear darker simply because more light's going into it than is going on that's be reflected off of it.
Okay, so that's a great science forum question, and I will give you both that question for homework. And,
you got it.
And on the next program, maybe we'll have some more follow-up. Let's go back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Ken in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Ken, you're up.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. I'm going to take you from space back down into the Earth.
Well, all
As
right.
a pilot, I periodically see the runway headings change after a runway has been paved. I know it's based on magnetic heading of the runway itself, and I'm assuming that magnetic variation occurs because of the molten center of the Earth and how it varies. But I've seen within my own lifetime significant magnetic changes. And as the second part of that question, does that heat, the center of the Earth, affect the temperature of the oceans?
Well, I'm going to leave the second one for Ed, but the first one, the Earth's magnetic, there are multiple elements that cause compass variation, deviation, and so forth. What you're seeing is magnetic variation. The Earth's magnetic field actually does move, and you probably know better than I was at about a degree a year, something on that order.
It's been floating around lately, I'll tell you that. Ed?
Yeah, it's moving towards Russia, actually, at the moment.
Right. And so the runway headings are designed to line up with an aircraft's compass, and that goes back to, you know, true versus magnetic. When you're flying, you're reliant on a directional gyro that is synced to a compass, so everything is in magnetic heading. So when they repave a runway or put a new runway in, they actually reassign the with the new variation. And we run about 15 degrees east or west here, correct, Ed?
More like 12 or 13, but yeah, that's about it.
Right.
Okay.
14.
Ed,
that being the difference between true north and magnetic north.
You know a lot about...
No, I understand.
Go ahead, Ken.
Go ahead.
No, you go.
No, I understood that. I was just curious as to whether it is caused by the core of the Earth and the molten movement of the Earth, the core.
Right. Now we'll let Ed answer.
Yep.
Yeah, because the core of the Earth is molten, in fact, the core of the Earth is actually solid with a molten ring around it, and because they move at slightly different speeds, the molten part of it actually forms eddies, eddy currents, and those eddy currents are what produces the magnetic signature. And it's really an additive and subtractive thing. Depending on which way those currents are moving, you'll get either effectively a north or a south variation, and they all add up to produce the north and south magnetic poles. So over time, as things rotate, and because it's a liquid, it changes. And that's what causes the variation in the orientation. Now, as far as the other part of the question is concerned, the oceans do not heat up because of the core of the Earth, although certainly heat gets out from the center of the Earth to the surface, especially along mid-Atlantic ridges, et cetera, where there's lava coming out. But generally speaking, that's a local thing, and that heat is pretty well taken up by the ocean currents and distributed elsewhere. So you don't have very hot areas in the Earth as a result. Right. The ocean as a result.
Ken, thanks so much. Now, Ed, before we get to the next call, you said we have a solid core and we have a molten sort of outside that core that swishes around.
Right.
And I've heard this before, but how do you know for sure? Have we gone all the way down there and checked it out?
Yeah, no, it's because the earthquake waves that go through the Earth, some can pass through liquids and some cannot. There's several types. There's a P wave, there's an S wave. The S wave is like a shear wave. If you were to take a bathtub and put your hand up and down through it, you don't make waves. You just pass your hand through it. The P wave, on the other hand, is more like a slinky, where you sort of make these waves through it as you move it back and forth, and they're able to actually move liquid. So the P wave can get through the liquid, the S wave can't, and as a result, by plotting out where these things occur, we can find out what the center of the Earth is like.
All right, last thing on the magnetic poles and the magnetic fields. It moves around. There is talk that, okay, at some point these poles are going to flip. And my question is not so much about the flipping of the poles. My question is, well, we know Mars once had a good magnetic field. I assume that that molten area of its core got cold and there were done.
Right.
When is that going to happen here?
Well, probably never.
Really?
Because the frictional resistance between the two parts actually keeps it pretty raw hot. It's possible, but first of all, Earth is a lot bigger than Mars. So it keeps a lot of heat in no matter what. And second of all, this frictional motion, it will cool somewhat, but it's going to take a very, very long time, certainly longer than I've got.
All right, so I shouldn't panic, basically.
I wouldn't worry too much about it.
All right, fair enough. Back to the phones. Gail and Half Moon. Gail, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to know, would it be possible to send something like a Voyager into a black hole to see what's in there?
Yeah, I don't think you'd find out what's in there, though.
Yeah, I don't think you'd be able to communicate out of there.
That's right. The black hole has got so much gravity. It's such a deep gravity well that everything gets trapped within it. So if it tried to send out a signal, you wouldn't get anything here.
Same as the earlier conversation on light. Radio waves and light propagate very similarly.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
If you'd like to, who'd like to come up with the money to do it, I'd love to try it, but I don't think we'd get anything out.
Gail, thanks a lot for the question. And this follow-up via email from Aaron and Rensselaer about the pole shifting, and I'll throw this one back to Ed first and then Roger.
Mm-hmm.
When the poles shift and switch places, how quickly does that occur? Is there a time when the North and South Pole will be at the equator? How long a time would that be?
Well, the pole switching was discovered by looking at lava flows. When lava is very, very hot, the magnetic material in it sort of flows around. When it cools off, it solidifies, and as it solidifies, these magnetic poles in the lava get trapped. So by measuring that, we can tell. Generally speaking, it probably takes about 1,000 to more years in order for a pole to switch. And we know that because as we're going up in the lava flow, we can actually see the switch, but very little time for the actual switching to occur. Chances are it might hit the equator for a day or two,
yeah.
But probably not much more than that.
All right, let's go to...
Yeah, you know,
oh,
the
go
thing
ahead,
that's
Roger.
Confusing to me is, well, you know, my, and I know this from my aviation charts, I thought the variation went east to west. You know, our compass corrections are east and west. So I didn't realize that the poles, that the magnetic field had a north-south rotation.
Oh, of course. Yeah, the variation, the declination, magnetic declination is from east to west, but it goes through the north-south poles. So
yes.
So it's very, very similar to lines of longitude, for example.
All right. Jim in Simsbury, Connecticut. Jim, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Thank you for taking my call. I am an occasional listener to WAMC.
Oh, good.
Because you only occasionally get the signal.
Oh, boy, that's bad. All right.
Other than streaming wires all over creation, is there a way to boost an FM signal?
Ah, well, let's put that over to our hi-fi guy, Roger Giboni.
Well,
Roger, what do you think?
Well, the answer is yes, okay? And I will tell you, WAMC is probably the best radio station at running what we call repeaters, okay? And what a repeater does is it's typically because of the frequency that FM communication, the 88 to 108 megahertz, they're typically line of sight. You can get some propagation, but in general, the communications is line of sight. So a repeater is put in the line of sight of an existing radio station, okay, typically at a high point, on a mountain point, and it retransmits the received signal on an alternate frequency. So you will hear WAMC announce their station identification, and they'll list a half a dozen different frequencies that they broadcast on. And what that's that chain of repeaters that goes all the way down the Catskills. And I think you guys go west a little too, don't you, Ray?
Yeah, and we go into Connecticut, but Connecticut's kind of dicey for us. I truly think that the old school way is the best in your situation, and that's the higher the better. Get an FM antenna up and put it up fairly high, and you'll probably be able to pick us up.
That's right.
And the other option is to stream it.
Well, you could do that
Where you're not using terrestrial radio. I mean, I'm a lover of terrestrial radio communications, but sometimes streaming is the better solution.
Out into the backyard.
What'd you say, Jim?
I'd like to be able to take the radio out into the backyard,
yeah,
away from my internet, from, you know, all that.
You know, you make a great point. I was talking about the power outage, which I've been experiencing at my house now for close to 24 hours. Boy, I tell you, the FM band and the AM band and the shortwave band, all that stuff is sounding so clean. There's no noise because there are no power lines or anything firing just stray RF into the atmosphere.
When all the cards are down, there's nothing like radio communications. It'll get through.
All right, Jim.
And there's of course 104.8 or whatever it is on the AM dial, and that is easy to get.
104.8 on the
Where's the AM station for WAMC?
Well, of course he's in Connecticut. We have one at 1400 here,
1400.
In Albany, but that would be a tough one, I think. That's you know, AM signals are fairly directional, and I have no idea if it points in that direction. I would have to look into that. Let's grab another call here before we wrap up, and let's go to Bob in Wilmington. Bob, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. I have a biology question. I haven't heard too many biology questions. I hope it's appropriate for the program.
All right.
That's because none of us are biologists.
But that's okay.
I just wanted maybe to take a shot at it, but... I didn't really know that, but
that's all right.
Specifically Darwin's theory of evolution, which I understand to be a theory of natural selection, natural or environmental selection, where the environment selects those creatures that will survive long enough to reproduce. Basically, I think that's what it amounts to.
Okay.
We talk about adaptation, but it's the species generally. It's not individuals, of course. But and the adaptation may be entirely fortuitous. But nonetheless, the environment decides which creatures will live and reproduce.
Right.
And therefore, that's why some become extinct and we have new species and so on. So my question is that we have gone so far in the world of medicine and science in in curing diseases and allowing people to live normal lifespans and reproduce
right.
With conditions that would have taken their lives years ago, absent the current treatments that we have. And this is wonderful.
We're running out of time.
It's a great... Okay, but are we doomed to be a species where every one of us is born with a genetic disability?
Interesting. All right, well, Ed, we'll let you handle that. We have 10 seconds.
Okay, basically the idea is that anything that's good for the society is necessarily not good for the individual. In other words, you can have a situation where an individual has a bad problem, and that could be bad for the society as a result. So, yes, we can run into major, major problems by allowing these things to increase in our gene pool.
Well, that's kind of a sobering way to end the program. Ed, how do we find out more about your activities over at COBE?
Go to cobleskill.edu. We're publishing pictures of the heavens all the time.
Beautiful. And Roger Ciboni, how do we find out more about Roger's High Fidelity?
Just go to Roger's High Fidelity on the internet. You'll learn all about us.
What is that, .com?
It is .com.
All right. Hey, guys, thanks a lot for being here. Beautiful job. Thanks to everybody who called in. Support comes from Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, paintings of people and pets from emailed photographs. No contact required. Completed work within 3 weeks or less. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. At Miss Hall School, offering a personalized educational experience for young women, hosting a virtual open house Saturday morning, October 10th, misshalls.org/open house. Once again, thanks to Ed Stander and Roger Ciboni for joining us. Thank you for listening. Terrific calls, terrific emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy. Wes Burton took the calls today. Our producer's Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's the Week in Review with Judy Patrick. And right now, stand by for the Capital Connection.